Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love this show, thank you again. And you may also love other great podcasts and shows and the journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our program going and helps NPR create new ones. So the best way to keep both Here and Now and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. Thanks.
President Trump visited Capitol Hill today to push for a tax overhaul that Senate Republicans hope to vote on this week. But several key senators remain on the fence. The Congressional Budget Office says the bill would balloon the deficit and primarily benefit wealthy Americans. We're joined from Capitol Hill by Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat from Ohio and ranking member on the Committee on Banking, Housing and Urban Affairs. Senator, welcome. And do you think the Republicans have the votes they need to pass this bill?
I know that they're making deals. I know their billionaire contributors are demanding this bill. Some House members and some Republicans in the Congress are actually saying that their contributors say don't bother calling back unless you pass the tax bill. That tells you everything. So they're at a fork in the road. So far, they seem to be walking down the path of sort of traditional special interest negotiate in the back room of the majority leader's office Republican tax cuts. And that's bad for this country. It hurts the middle class. We know every time they pass a tax bill for the rich that the middle class shrinks.
So do you think they'll have the votes in the end?
I don't know. I think it depends on the deals they cut. And it's the more information that comes out by 2021, people earning $40,000 or less will actually be net losers under this bill. How could you possibly, when the rich are getting richer in this country, the top 1% just continue to grab a bigger and bigger share of the American pie? How can you give them more and cut and raise taxes on people making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $75,000 a year? So I think it's a close vote. I think it depends on how much the public raises its voice and sends emails and makes phone calls to their senators and House members.
Well, let me go to that point, because as you mentioned, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, says this plan could actually hurt the poor. But Senator Pat Toomey, your Republican colleague, told Morning Edition today that the tax bill would be a tax cut for low-income Americans and for middle-income Americans, in part because it gets rid of the individual mandate to buy health insurance or pay a penalty. Let's listen.
We're going to directly lower their taxes in a variety of ways. One of them is they're not going to have to pay this penalty anymore. So that is very constructive.
Now, about 6 million people or so actually ended up paying that penalty for not having health insurance at last check. But what's your response to that, that getting rid of the individual mandate in Obamacare is actually a tax cut for some?
Well, the Congressional Budget Office. And who are you? Whom are you going to believe in the end? The Congressional Budget Office, a bipartisan, nonpartisan group of professionals, are a very ideological, very, very conservative U.S. senator. The fact is that the CBO has said there'll be $25 billion cuts to Medicare, that 13 million people will lose their insurance, hundreds of thousands in my home state of Ohio, that premiums will go up 10%. And while you cut taxes on some of maybe $200 to $300 on a working family in Ohio, in Cleveland or in Toledo or in Youngstown, you're taking money out of their pocket when you take the subsidies that they had for health insurance. So you take more out of their pockets than you put in, and you can play all the math games that any U.S. senator sitting on the Finance Committee wants to play. It's where Republicans always go when they meet in their special interest groups in the back room. That's why the middle class continues to shrink in this country. That's why the rich are getting richer, and this will just accelerate that trend. We all know that in this body. Some don't want to recognize it because they do the bidding of their billionaire contributors far too often.
I want to ask you about the fight over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which right now has two leaders, the White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney, who is serving at the request of the president, and Leandra English, who was named acting director by the outgoing director, Richard Cordray. English has taken her claim to court. What do you think she should do?
Well, I'm pleased that she's taking the claim to court. If you play this out, the Trump administration, if they win on this one, you are going to see more and more interim appointments like Mulvaney here who don't go through Senate confirmation, and then they have no ethics rules when they return to the private sector. And the president could just do a number of these at agency after agency, putting interim people in. I'm not a lawyer, but I know in the Constitution, advise and consent means advise and consent. It doesn't mean the president's all-powerful to continue and install people in. But I think when this is really not about Mulvaney, it's not about English. It really is about the people that the Consumer Bureau has helped. And one of the first things that Mulvaney did was stop the payment. He froze the civil penalty payments, that money that was going to thousands of Americans all over the country who had been cheated by banks. So he is basically saying, the banks aren't going to have to pay these fines, these civil penalties, because I'm the director. Now we're just going to freeze those. I mean, I want somebody, really in the end, it's whose side are you on? And are you on working American side or on the side of the Wall Street banks? And I'm very concerned about all these nominees. I mean, the people that the president are putting in at so many of these regulatory agencies, he puts somebody in head of the EPA who is hostile to safe drinking water and clean air laws. He puts people in Department of Education who are hostile to public education. I mean, she pretty much says that. You have the head of the Office of the Comptroller of Currency. They're either a lawyer for Wall Street or they're a Wall Street banker in far too many cases. As he talked about draining the swamp, he's really putting these regulators all over the government to again side with Wall Street. And I guess I don't, that's not my definition of draining the swamp in this town.
One more question, Senator Brown. You are from Ohio, which is by some measures the overdose capital of the country, one of the centers of the opioid crisis. President Trump recently declared the crisis a public health emergency, but he stopped short of calling it a national emergency. Do you see any end in sight to the opioid crisis?
I of course there's an end in sight, but the government hasn't risen to the occasion. The state legislature in Ohio has fallen abysmally short on this. The President of the United States should have issued an executive order in a state of emergency and really put the forces of the resources of the federal government across federal agencies the way you do for a major public health emergency in another way, or a hurricane, or an Ebola outbreak, or poll, anything like that. And the president went in the right direction. He fell short. Congress has fallen short on this. There is an end in sight, but we're not seeing it yet until we see all levels of society. It means local groups that don't have the resources to in Chillicothe, Ohio, to scale up their treatment, to better education. It means making the drug companies more responsible. It's I don't want to point fingers. It's everybody, but we need all hands on deck. And so far, the White House hasn't seen it that way.
That's Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat from Ohio. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thank you, Chair.
Well, here's a statistic. 1/3 of Americans will contract shingles, the blistering rash caused by the reawakening of the chickenpox virus. It can be excruciatingly painful and cause long-term complications, especially in older people. But there's a new vaccine coming soon. Carrie Goldberg from member station WBUR reports.
Dr. Ben Kruskal recently learned firsthand how much it hurts when you get shingles.
There was sort of a baseline pain that was not easily described, but very, very unpleasant. But the other piece was an extreme sensitivity to touch, such that even a very light touch in certain areas of my face was exquisitely painful.
Kruskal, who's the chief of infectious disease at Boston-based Atrius Health, says he feels very lucky to be back to normal now after a few weeks. 1/5 of the people who get shingles face lasting complications, usually chronic, debilitating pain.
The real problem with shingles is that it doesn't get any respect.
Dr. Anne Louise Oaklander is director of the nerve unit at Massachusetts General Hospital and sees patients with some of the worst effects of shingles: stroke, vision loss, spinal cord damage. She says because shingles involves a visible rash, like poison ivy, people think it can't be serious. But in fact, it's a neurologic disease that can cause long-lasting damage to nerves.
What's really sad is that the older you are, the more likely the pain is to persist longer and longer. And so this really becomes a public health emergency in older people in particular.
Since 2006, a shingles vaccine called Zostavax has been recommended for people over 60, but it's only 50% effective, and what protection it does offer fades. less than a third of eligible older Americans have gotten it. Now, the FDA has approved a new shingles vaccine called Shingrix, recommended for people 50 and older. Dr. Tomas Breuer is the chief medical officer of GSK Vaccines, which makes Shingrix. He says the vaccine will come on the market next month.
However, the real pickup will only start in the first half of 2018.
That's in part because it will take time for health insurance plans to cover it. And without coverage, it's expected to cost $280. The cost is not the only downside to Shingrix.
There's a lot of side effects from this thing.
Dr. Richard Dupuy is chief of geriatrics at Tufts Medical Center.
Not only just the local pain, redness, and swelling, but also systemic effects, and that is achy bones and feeling fatigue and headaches and other side effects. And they last for 2 or 3 days.
Dupuy says Shingrix uses a new adjuvant. That's a substance that boosts the body's immune response to a vaccine. Studies published in the New England Journal of Medicine found that Shingrix is highly effective at preventing shingles, 97% effective overall and 90% in people over 70.
That's pretty compelling reason to get this thing. And I think that if we can get beyond the side effects, I think this is going to probably be a big deal.
It is, if Dr. Ben Kreskel is any indication. His recent shingles does not guarantee he won't get it again, so he'll get the vaccine.
I am by nature very skeptical about medications, including vaccines, and I have to say this one looks awfully good, and I will get it as soon as it is available and recommended by my primary care physician.
And it's likely he'll be far from alone. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
Virginia is preparing to send a letter to thousands of families telling them their children's health care through the federal CHIP program may be canceled. The Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, was created in 1997 by the Republican Orrin Hatch and the Democrat Ted Kennedy to protect now 9 million kids and thousands of pregnant women who are not poor enough for Medicaid but not making enough to buy insurance. The federal government partly covers the program in some states, covers all the costs in poorer states. Funding was not renewed by Congress on September 30th, and so now many states will run out of money by the end of December. Linda Nablo is Chief Deputy Director of Virginia's Department of Medical Assistance Services. Linda, your funds will be gone by January. You were scheduled to send your letter this week. What's going on?
At this point, because we're hearing from Congress that there's a possibility Congress will use the continuing resolution to reauthorize CHIP, and that is must be passed by December 8th, We're not sending the letter out on December 1st as originally intended, because the last thing we want to do is scare parents and then turn right around and have to tell them, sorry, never mind, Congress has finally acted and your coverage is safe.
Boy, this has been such a roller coaster.
Oh, it's terrible. At this point, the draft letter says your child may lose coverage. You know, we'll let you know as soon as we know.
And so what's been the impact? What have you seen CHIP do?
Well, CHIP is along with Medicaid, is credited with drastically reducing the uninsured rate among America's children. You know, 20 years ago, I think the uninsured rate among children was 14 or 15%. It's down now to less than 5%. There's also many studies that talk about children on CHIP get their immunizations. It's required that they get dental care. There are many positive health outcomes from having coverage and being able to take your child to the doctor when you need to.
There was a surge of emergency room visits because families, you know, wouldn't take a child who had symptoms to a doctor until the symptoms were so severe they'd end up in emergency rooms. I mean, is that what you were seeing before CHIP?
Certainly. That's pretty common if you don't have health insurance. You wait until you don't have a choice. And that, of course, is worse for the child and worse for all of us in terms of the cost.
I mean, are children with serious illnesses also on the CHIP program?
Absolutely. I think we cover at this point over 1,000 children in cancer treatment. We cover babies born, you know, with HIV or addicted to substances.
And we keep saying bipartisan. Everyone agrees that it's had this fabulous effect, not just in helping children, but on the bottom line. What do you think about what's happening now politically? We had that exchange with Senator Sherrod Brown saying sharply to Orrin Hatch, again, a founder of the program, why don't you back up your concern for the poor by extending CHIP? And Hatch responded, I'm not starting with CHIP.
It's very disturbing. I don't think you could find a senator or a representative who would say they don't support CHIP. They are caught in a very partisan struggle over how to pay for it. If they can't do this, I don't know how they can do anything.
Well, in the meantime, what do your CHIP recipients in Virginia do? Do they go to a marketplace? I mean, what do they do?
Well, their choices are probably limited, but there are some things they would need to explore. If, for example, their income has dropped since they first applied for CHIP, they might qualify for Medicaid, so we need to reevaluate that. If their child is very sick and they have accumulated or will soon accumulate once CHIP ends, very large medical bills, there's such a thing as a spend down because of medical bills until you become eligible for Medicaid. So they need to be aware that that might be an option if their child's very sick. Yes, the marketplace, go to the marketplace, find out what the cost would be. If Congress eventually reauthorizes this program, you may only need that coverage for a few months. You may go to your employer. If your employer offers family coverage, perhaps you can afford for at least a few months to put your child on that. The truth is a lot will end up uninsured. That's probably the majority of what will happen. But every family needs to kind of assess their situation and explore what might be options for them.
Do you think some of the wealthier states will be able to just find money somewhere?
I will be amazed if any state, especially with this short notice, it's not just a question of money, which is significant. It's everybody keeps saying Congress will do this. So states are not prepared. If they had been preparing 2 years ago to know that CHIP would end and figure out what part of it, if any of it, they could continue with state funds, you might see more of that. But at this point, states are in the middle of their fiscal years. In Virginia, the whole CHIP budget is about $323 million, and the federal government pays 88% of that. So to expect a state to be able to just, come up with over $250 million with almost no warning to maintain coverage is pretty unrealistic. But all of that takes time and money to work out. And we don't have either at this point.
Linda Nablow, Chief Deputy Director at Virginia's Department of Medical Assistance Services. Linda, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin, for helping us get this word out.
Yesterday, President Trump continued to mock Senator Elizabeth Warren by calling her Pocahontas, but this time he did it in an Oval Office ceremony meant to honor Native American code breakers from World War II in front of a huge portrait of President Andrew Jackson, who signed the Indian Removal Act in 1830 and oversaw the Trail of Tears, the forced move to Oklahoma during which more than 4,000 Native Americans died. Mark Trahant is a journalism professor at the University of North Dakota, former editor of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe. He joins us by Skype. Mark, your thoughts?
Well, it was a kind of par-for-the-course insult. Really, it's been going on since the campaign. In fact, the first time he used the slur was in North Dakota when he was championing the oil industry. This is the first time he did it at the White House when a group supposedly honoring Native Americans.
Well, remind us why this is such a slur. Pocahontas, the daughter of a Native American chief who, legend holds, saved the life of Captain John Smith by laying her head on his when he was about to be executed, later kidnapped by the English. What does that mean to your ear when he says Pocahontas?
Well, she has a remarkable story, and it's one worth telling. But the way he did it was to denigrate her name and to use it as a slur. It would be the same if somebody used any historical name and reduced it to a caricature.
Well, and what do you think of Elizabeth Warren's claim? This, of course, came up when she was running for the Senate. She said, I never asked my mom for documentation. We always thought my mother's family was part Cherokee, part Delaware, and that's why my parents had to elope. She only checked that off when she had her tenure at Harvard. She never used it on any applications.
Indian identity is very complicated anyway. And really, the standard is citizenship. And clearly, she doesn't meet that test. And so for her, I think it's best if she just let it rest and say, yes, I have these family stories, but there is no evidence to back it up, and move on.
What about the Andrew Jackson portrait? Could have been just an oversight on the part of the Trump administration, but what did that say to you, this huge portrait looming behind this event?
Andrew Jackson, in so many ways, is representing the complexity that is America. And Donald Trump has certainly made him prominent. This narrative of Jackson, of destruction of Indian country, is one that comes up a lot. And you would think in this context, the president would have just done it somewhere else.
Was this a dog whistle? Or maybe as damning, revealing that there's no one in the White House with this cultural awareness who would have pointed this out?
At the very least, there's no one at the White House with cultural awareness. But I think it was intentional. I think they do want to show Jackson as this great commander. I mean, it was so clearly prominent that I think it was by design. You look at the public policy applications of this, and there's already a really disinclination to listen to tribal governments.
And there are millions of Native American children who are affected by the fact that the CHIP program for the poor has not been extended. This is health care for kids. Is that part of your sense here? You've written about this, that the whole Pocahontas controversy, although important, takes over any other narrative.
Exactly. I mean, it's so easy to get an outrage over something like this. It's so expected. But what we're now seeing is these real public policy applications that are not getting the same kind of debate, especially in the media. One of the things that with healthcare that's just so amazing is that when the Indian Health Service runs out of money, it starts using what's called a life and limb standard, that you don't get care unless you're actually threatened with life and limb. And you can imagine what that means for ordinary people going to see the doctor who don't meet that test.
And by the way, this fight between the president and the senator is really a proxy fight over the Consumer Finance Protection Board. She helped create it when she was a lawyer at Harvard. He has been, well, you know, we have two people running it right now. Your sense of that, that this moment for code talkers became a proxy for another political battle?
I mean, that's just one of the political battles. I think he's also trying to make sure that she's not a legitimate candidate for president in 3 years.
You mentioned children's health. What else do you think is important for people to know about Native nations?
You know, this country has made extraordinary promises through treaties that really set a high standard for what its test should be. And yet, no Congress, no president has ever come close, and now we're going backwards. Instead of funding the Indian health system or funding education, the Congress is saying, we can't afford it. And if you can't afford the promises that are at the core of this country, it really begs the question, what kind of country we live in? One other thing, I just wish the press was more open to narratives beyond these ones that we know will go viral and start actually getting out and reporting on Indian country. And part of the problem is there's just not enough Native American representation in the media.
Mark Trahant, again, a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, also a journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. Thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
And to Mark's point about the media, Indian Country Today, a weekly newspaper run by the Oneida Nation, went dark in September. The CEO said it just wasn't sustainable. The paper's assets were donated to the Congress of American Indians. That is quite a loss. The man in line to be the next head of the Federal Reserve went before the Senate today, and Jerome Powell told lawmakers at his confirmation hearing he'll bring continuity to the job.
If confirmed, I would strive along with my colleagues to support the economy's continued progress toward full recovery. We expect interest rates to rise somewhat further and the size of our balance sheet to gradually shrink. However, while we endeavor to make the path of policy as predictable as possible, the future cannot be known with certainty.
President Trump picked Powell to replace current Fed Chair Janet Yellen. He's been a member of the Fed's board since 2012. Let's get the thoughts of Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent, and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Robin. This is, you know, I love talking about the Fed.
Yes, you do. It's at cocktail parties.
Yeah.
Well, the last federal Fed chairs were all economists,
yep.
And that's going back to Paul Volcker and the Carter and Reagan administrations. Powell's an investment banker. So does that make a difference?
So generally, I would say yes. It's not a good thing to not have an economist. I would say that if I were defending Powell and Donald Trump's decision, the Fed is very deep with economists. It has a great deal of economic research and experts there. So I don't think that it costs him too much not being an economist. And of course, he's been on the Fed. So I think that's okay. He's worked with Janet Yellen on a daily basis for years, and he sort of indicated that there would be no major shift in monetary policy despite his being an investment banker. There are a few things around the edges of concern, but I don't think that's it.
Well, we heard him say that he expected interest rates to rise. They had been historically low and are slowly coming up under Janet Yellen's direction. But aren't there concerns that he might, as we've seen other appointees do, move to pull back regulations?
Yeah, so he largely supports Dodd-Frank, which is a good thing from a continuity perspective. But he's urged Congress to rewrite one major provision of Dodd-Frank, which you must have heard about. It's called the Volcker Rule. You and I have talked about it. It is the rule that is meant to prevent banks from making risky bets using taxpayer money. And some argue that the absence of that is what caused the Great Recession. He'll still be tough on banks. He probably would be less tough on banks than Janet Yellen. But again, the Fed is only one of the organizations that governs the banks in this country. In his 5 years as a member of the Fed's Board of Governors, he has built a reputation as a centrist. So he looks like he'll keep the interest rate hikes going at a very slow pace, as we're expecting. And he has said that some regulation should be dialed back.
Well, the economy has now been expanding since the bottom of the recession you mentioned, 2009. But most chairs face or have the possibility of facing one. Is there a sense he can handle that?
Yeah, so there's a tough issue here. The Fed has two things that it wants to happen. It wants good unemployment, and it wants inflation at a particular level, a 2% target. We've had very low inflation in the United States, partly because oil prices are at a lower rate than we thought there would be a lower price. And Janet Yellen, in fact, Jerome Powell said in an interview in August, he said this low inflation is a kind of a mystery. So you don't want to raise rates when you've got low inflation. So he's got a bit of a quandary in front of him, but there are lots of economists who talk and think about this every day. But that'll be his challenge. What do you do with interest rates when inflation remains so low? Generally speaking, you wouldn't want to increase them.
Well, his confirmation process, you tell us, is expected to be pretty uncontroversial, but we will continue to follow it. And it's a name I think we're going to start becoming familiar.
We'll be saying a lot.
Yeah. Jerome Powell. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you so much.
Cyber Monday sales hit a record high this year in the U.S., $6.6 billion online, up nearly 17% from last year. That's according to Adobe Analytics. An estimated 42% of those sales belong to Amazon. But it's not just the U.S. market that Amazon wants. This month, it released its Echo Voice Assistant in India, making it one of just four countries where it is available. For more on this, let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Ed Lee is managing editor at Recode and joins us from New York. Hi, Ed.
Hey.
And let's start by listening to the Echo Voice Assistant in India. You can ask it for the weather in Mumbai.
Currently, in Mumbai, Maharashtra, it's 31 degrees with dreary skies. Tonight, you can expect clear skies with a low of 24 degrees.
I don't know if they would say dreary here. And it will also tell you the date of the Hindu holiday Diwali.
Diwali will be on Wednesday, the 7th of November, 2018.
Okay, so what we're hearing there is in English. The Indian Alexa actually speaks Hinglish, a combination of Hindi and English. But do you still have to speak English to communicate with her?
Yes, largely it's still an English-based system. But as Amazon indicates, it's what they call Hinglish or local English, right? So, you know, the English as spoken there is slightly different, not just in terms of certain words, but also tone and inflection. When Amazon made the Echo for the UK market, it had to adjust that language processing as well because, of course, UK English is also different.
Yeah, and Amazon said it took about a year's worth of work. Why so long to do this?
So it just comes down to the speech recognition. I think that's a big part of it. There is a, you know, artificial intelligence software that underneath all of this stuff, but you still have to train it. And I think that's it just still takes time. You have to have a lot of inputs in there. And that's why it took so long or, you know, relatively speaking, took so long.
Who are Amazon's biggest competitors in India?
So there are homegrown players. Flipkart, that's the market leader, in fact. They're the biggest. And then Amazon is a close second. There's a third player called Snapdeal. And it seems like there might be a tie-up, a merger between Flipkart and Snapdeal, which would just make it that much harder for Amazon to compete. Though, you know, they kind of go neck and neck sometimes. Sometimes Amazon's slightly ahead, but lately it seems like Flipkart has sort of taken the lead.
And Amazon is focusing on India rather than China because of restrictions from the government in China?
restrictions from the government of China, it's still a bit of a mystery. I mean, government, of course, doesn't make it easy for U.S. companies to operate there, and Amazon saw that firsthand. In addition to that, you know, Alibaba is a huge, huge competitor there. They basically won that market, at least for now. And I think that's another reason why Amazon was sort of not forced out, but they were forced to kind of relinquish, right? And now they sell their own products through the Alibaba system instead of their own.
And the Echo, as I mentioned, is only available in four countries around the world: the U.S., the U.K., Germany, and now India. Do similar products have a wider reach?
No, I mean, so Amazon is definitely the market leader in terms of this voice-based system. Google is coming closer as a second, but it's a distant second. And right now, like Google Home, for example, is only available in the U.S. They're working on the U.K. I think it'll be in the available U.K. soon. That seems to be sort of the step up. But the bigger picture here is that these voice-based systems is sort of seen as the next evolution of computing, right? So we went from desktop to mobile. Voice is seen as the next iteration, and I think that's what they're all really competing for. It's not just a way to sell more stuff. It's really to sort of own the future platform.
So what are the next markets, do you think?
Well, I think India will still take a long time for it to figure out. But then after that, I think, you know, you're looking at South America, which is a growing market as well in terms of e-commerce. And other parts of Europe still haven't really been tapped into in terms of these types of devices and these types of modes of communication. So that's also certainly ripe for, you know, for market domination,
yeah,
as Bezos likes to do.
Is it curious to you that they haven't gone to a place like France or Spain or someplace like that rather than India, which has such a wide income disparity?
That's exactly right. But the promise of the market size in India is what's drawing them. And also, it's still nascent enough that if you get your foothold in now, you're better off in the future, unlike, say, where in China, where Amazon was probably a little late to the start. And yes, there is wide income disparity, but things like mobile phones are still very widely used or sort of has taken the leap in India. And that seems to be the mode that a lot of people are using to access the internet and buy things. So there's a weird dual sort of dynamic going on there where there's people sort of accessing the internet in this low-level way, but then also there's still people who have yet to get on there.
That's Ed Lee, Managing Editor at Recode. Ed, thank you.
Anytime.
Today in Myanmar, Pope Francis did not mention the Rohingya Muslims in a highly anticipated speech. More than 600,000 Rohingya have fled to neighboring Bangladesh because of the violence committed against them by Myanmar's military. The military denies it has raped and murdered civilians, but the U.S. and the U.N. have called the violence ethnic cleansing. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli is traveling with the Pope. She joins us from Yangon on Skype. And Sylvia, tell us more about the Pope's speech. What do you make of the way he handled the Rohingya issue?
Well, you know, this year the Pope had singled out the Rohingya by name in several of his public appeals denouncing their persecution. But local church leaders had beseeched Francis not to use the word Rohingya here in Myanmar. It's a very polarizing name in this country because the Buddhist majority considers the Rohingya Muslims illegal migrants who come from Bangladesh, even though they have lived here for many generations. And this is a very widespread conviction here. Local Catholics fear that if the Pope did say the word, Buddhist nationalists and the military that has been waging the crackdown against the Rohingya could carry out reprisals against Catholics and other Christian minorities.
Why do they think that? Why do they think that it would be difficult for Catholics if the Pope had used the term Rohingya?
Well, they just fear because they really hate this group, and they fear if the Pope took their side, well, there's a very strong Buddhist nationalist movement here, and we see what the military has been doing, and the Christians are a very small, unprotected minority. Like, there are many, many other minorities here also in the country, and the Christians are one of them, the Catholics also.
Does it hurt the Pope's credibility outside of Myanmar at all that he didn't bring this up directly?
Well, we'll have to see. Certainly, I think that human rights activists here and outside, and of course the Rohingya themselves, are very, very disappointed by the Pope's semantic balancing act. But you know, he spoke indirectly. He did say, he spoke very clearly about the need for that every single ethnic group and their identity, none excluded, should be respected. He made a strong statement. He went around it. He didn't give them by name, but the buzzwords were there.
Now, before the speech, Pope Francis met with Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner who has been harshly criticized for not doing more to help the Rohingya. Do we know anything about what was discussed at that meeting and what she has said about the Rohingya during the Pope's visit?
We do not know what they said privately. This was also not their first meeting. They had met in May at the Vatican when the Vatican and Myanmar established diplomatic relations for the first time. It was, and in her public speech today, she did not mention the Rohingya, as I believe she never has. But she did refer to the region where the crackdown is centered. She said that in the Rakhine state, there's been an erosion of trust and understanding, harmony and cooperation. That's as much as sort of she went there. And then, as I said, the Pope stressed that the importance is on respecting human rights of every group and its identity, none excluded.
Now, this is day two of the Pope's 4-day visit to Myanmar. What's the rest of his trip look like? What's the schedule?
Well, tomorrow he will celebrate Mass here in Yangon with the Catholic community, and then he's going to meet with the country's top body of Buddhist monks. Also today, earlier today, before going to the capital, he had a meeting with representatives of the various religions. He's going to push a lot on this whole interreligious dialogue. I think this is also something that he's going to stress very much. He thinks that peace can only be reached through respect of all the religious groups. And then on Friday, he goes to Bangladesh, a mostly Muslim nation. There, the Catholic community is very small, but it plays an important role in the welfare system with a very wide network of schools, hospitals, and clinics that cater to all citizens. And it's in Bangladesh that the Pope will finally meet with a group of Rohingya refugees. So once again, everybody will be closely listening to see if this time outside of Myanmar, he will say their name in public.
It's NPR's Sylvia Poggioli in Yangon in Myanmar. Sylvia, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And by the way, on this trip so far, no Pope mobile. The Pope's been in a small car with the windows down. Sylvia tells us he likes to be amongst the people.
Indiana University voted last night to temporarily suspend fraternity events on its Bloomington campus, the latest attempt by university officials across the country to stop dangerous alcohol abuse and hazing. But at the University of Texas at Austin, there is a different story unfolding. As Nadia Hamdan reports from member station KUT, a new sorority for Muslims recently opened its doors.
It's just before 6 o'clock in the evening. A group of 10 women slowly trickle into a classroom. Tonight is their sorority's first chapter meeting. Each young woman sits at a desk with a binder and focuses on their president, Maria Hasim.
I was personally very, very excited and very, very nervous about my first chapter meeting. This is my first time doing it, but inshallah, I'll go ahead and I'll start doing it. And I know each semester I'll get better.
She uses the word inshallah, a commonly used Arabic expression that means God willing. Hasim feels comfortable invoking the name of Allah because this is a meeting of Mu Delta Alpha, the nation's first college-based Muslim sorority. Their founder is Samira Maddox.
I wanted somewhere that I can fit in while I was in college and have that full college experience.
Maddox started the sorority 3 years ago at the University of Texas at Dallas. She was born in Somalia, grew up in Canada, and has been living in the U.S. for 10 years. She says she started MDA simply because she was trying to find something like it on campus and couldn't.
I felt like there wasn't a place of belonging for me, being a Muslim woman, African-American. I was like, you know, maybe if we could have something for women only in a university, what could that be? It happens to be a sorority.
This year, the sorority launched 2 new chapters in Texas. Each campus held their rush week in September, and now over 60 young women call themselves Sisters of Mu Delta Alpha. But Maddox says reaching this milestone wasn't easy.
We were struggling so much that, you know, it took a while to get here.
Maddox received pushback when she decided to start MDA. Although UT Dallas supported her efforts, it was difficult to find a faculty advisor. She heard a lot of no's.
We could tell that people were scared. They've never had anything like this. You know, just Muslim people coming out of nowhere and saying, hey, do you want to be our advisor? You'll be responsible for any event that we do. You'll be the one who advocates for us at the school. There was a lot of pushback on that.
Even after she finally got an advisor, there were other challenges ahead. Their first rush brought in over a dozen young Muslim women. But some worried it would be a stereotypical Greek experience with parties and drinking. A strict adherence to the Muslim faith means no alcohol, and many of those first pledges decided not to join. That left MDA's founding class with only three people.
Everybody who thinks of sororities, they have the idea of the movies. You know, all those parties and in the houses or whatever they have. That's what people were thinking initially we were going to do. To them, it's like, why would you want to do that?
After a couple years at UT Dallas, people started to understand that Mu Delta Alpha's focus is less about the social and more about the professional. Their aim is to be a positive force for young women to help them on their journey to a successful career, while at the same time focusing on their Islamic identity. UT Austin chapter president Maria Hassim says one of their main goals is to find successful Muslim women and make them accessible to its sisters. They do that in part through a speaker series.
Essentially, I really wanted like this mentorship program that provided mentors that understood the types of struggles that Muslim women go through or Muslim girls go through as they grow up.
And it's that focus on young Muslim girls that sparked the idea for their first annual event, the Young Muslimas Summit. This year, the sorority held a conference in Dallas for around 200 young Muslim women ages 9 to 15. They offered workshops tackling topics such as body image, bullying, and education, and brought in speakers, including Bilqis Abdelkadir, the Muslim-American basketball player who was banned by the International Basketball Federation from playing in her hijab. She fought the ban and won. Sorority founder Samira Maddox says it's stories like that that she hopes will shatter the common misconceptions of Muslim women.
She needs to walk behind her husband. She has no say. She can't be a leader. She is not excellent. She has to stay at home because she's oppressed. But you know what? The most oppressive thing is when people believe that, especially women, when a woman thinks that I'm not empowered the same way as her.
Back in the classroom, one of the newest pledges of Mu Delta Alpha, UT sophomore Lina Barakat says an organization like this was just what she needed.
Being Muslim to me is everything. It's the best part of me, I think. And I don't know, like my dream, I want to work in the UN. And I don't see that sort of role model yet. And so what I really love here is that we're becoming the mentors that we don't have right now.
She hopes other young pledges will look to her one day and say, I want to do what she's doing. When that happens, Barakat says she'll be right there, extending a hand. For Here and Now, I'm Nadia Hamdan.
Thank you for being with us on Here and Now, a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.